This is The Record on KUOW at 1210. The National Office of the Fraternity Beta Theta Pi has suspended operations at their University of Washington chapter after allegations of hazing. Representatives from Beta Theta Pi headquarters in Oxford, Ohio, are coming to Seattle to figure out what, if anything, went wrong and what to do next. Turns out that universities have limited control over their fraternities. Norm Arkins is an official at the University of Washington. He says the fraternity's national office suspended the chapter immediately after they got the allegations.
The chapter cannot function. They're like frozen. They can't function right now as a fraternity. They are not participating in fraternity and sorority activities. They can't do the things that other fraternities and sororities do, like register parties and hold parties and recruit new members. They are suspended at the moment, and that suspension will last either until the international headquarters decides whether to put the chapter on probation or extend their suspension or terminate them, and then, of course, it will depend on what we decide to do with regard to disciplining individual students if they violated the student conduct code.
Yeah, if that should happen, what are the options that the university has to deal with, to take further steps of discipline?
So fraternities and sororities are private member organizations. They are not formally part of the university. They're private organizations. People could continue to live there, right, because it's a residential house, but they wouldn't be able to have access to recruitment lists. They wouldn't be able to participate in other Greek activities that are organized by the Greek system, and they wouldn't have recognition as an official university fraternity and sorority. I mean, that's the most we could do. We don't have really power to do more than say, well, you can't really function here as a fraternity or a sorority.
Norm Arkins is an official at the University of Washington. Atlantic Magazine writer Caitlin Flanagan spent a year exploring what happens when things go wrong at frat houses. Flanagan says that when the national arm of a fraternity comes to investigate an incident like they're doing here, fraternity brothers often think the cavalry has arrived to save them. But that is not the case.
If your son is a member of a fraternity that's about to be investigated by the national, you want to tell him, do not follow fraternity procedure, which is to go back to the chapter house and wait for the national to show up. You want to tell him to walk away as quickly as he can from the chapter house and to call his own lawyer, because the people from the national fraternity aren't on his side. They're on the side of indemnifying the fraternity against any legal action by this injured member, this injured pledge. So the people that are coming to investigate really aren't on the side of the individual members.
How have these investigations been successful at reducing the number of these types of hazing incidents at campuses around the country?
Nobody knows for sure. That's really closely guarded information. One thing that I've noticed is that hazing has been explicitly prohibited by all of the fraternities for a number of decades now. Yet we haven't seen any reduction year after year after year of the numbers of hazing incidents that get reported. And remember, most hazing incidents don't get reported. Most hazing incidents are endured by the young men who are forced to go through it and then perpetrated by them on the next group. So we almost never, in my belief, ever really hear about anything like the number of hazing incidents that go on in the fraternity houses.
And it sounds as though the national offices of the fraternities are very focused on limiting their liability when they come in to take a look at these situations. Have they been successful at avoiding liability in these cases?
Hazing is they've certainly been successful in a lot of other things that happen in fraternity houses. Again, alcohol poisoning, sexual assault, assault and batteries, horrendous slip and falls, which are quite common. They've been remarkably successful in those respects because they can say, well, they broke the rule, they drank under age 21, so many of this is tied to alcohol use that they're not old enough to use, therefore we're not liable. Hazing is different because hazing is specifically connected to an institutionalized specific set of ritualized behaviors that go hand in hand with fraternity membership, that some chapters have completely eradicated and it doesn't go on at all, but it goes way deep back into the old 19th century history of these fraternities. I tell you right now, there are young men and middle-aged men driving and listening to this report, and they're getting angry because they had the best experience of their lives in fraternities. And there are parents who will say the best thing that ever happened to their son was joining a fraternity. So it's by no means some evil cabal that has to be stamped out. But on the other hand, it is certainly a nationwide industry that takes place on thousands of American campuses and has a deep, long history of deaths, sexual torture, sexual assault, and the inflicted trauma of hazing. So I think it's something that absolutely bears much more investigation than it currently has.
Hazing involves humiliation and debasement. Why are young men willing to go through hazing in order to be in fraternities?
History of hazing is fascinating, and it's tied really closely to the difference between military experience and college experience. Hazing really went on the uptick after the Civil War because there was an idea that there was this huge number of American young men who had been tested in war. And then there was this very guilty generation, maybe younger brothers and maybe sons, who thought to themselves, I haven't had that military testing. And so hazing got a lot more violent after the Civil War. It became more violent again after the Second World War. There were a lot of returning vets, and typically the ones who had seen active combat didn't want anything to do with fraternities and were disgusted by them. They'd seen real human carnage. They were not going to be paddled by some idiot and told to wear a beanie. But a lot of young men who, in the Second World War, hadn't seen, you know, had desk jobs, they came back with a certain amount of anxiety about that, and they really amped up this military level of hazing. And I think, you know, to the side of the sort of glamorous and attractive side of fraternity life, you know, there's a reason that at every single production of Henry V, whether it's seventh graders sawing through to the Royal Shakespeare Company, when Prince Hal, now Henry, gets up and gives his speech about the Band of Brothers, everybody has a tear in their eye. There's something very attractive about this idea of young men united to one another in lifelong fealty and to a cause greater to themselves and having to risk their lives to stay true to that. I think all of that is a deeply, there's a reason that's a kind of ancient idea, and I think it reasserts itself deeply and tacitly and unintentionally in these very sophomoric acts of hazing and in college fraternities in America.
Caitlin Flanagan, she's a writer for The Atlantic, and she wrote much more on this subject earlier this year in an article called The Dark Power of Fraternities, based on her investigation. And Marcy, as we heard, there's the national part of a fraternity is investigating a local fraternity right here at the University of Washington campus on accusations of hazing. We don't know what happened. That'll probably come out later on. This is The Record from KUOW. I'm Ross Reynolds with Marcy Silman.